A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. This is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the studios. With me today, editor Simon Lambert is here with journalists Lee Boyce and Mark Schoffman in the studio for their weekly catch-up, where they're talking about the stories that they've been investigating this week, including more trouble with pensioner bonds. This time, it's the Post. Also, fixed mortgage rates fall towards 1%, but how low can they go? Well, now for the future of peer-to-peer and crowdfunding, after the city watchdog cracks down, saying investors aren't being warned of the risks. And as the Six Nations gets underway, are ridiculous ticket prices turning you off sport? Well, journalist Lee Boyce, a loyal Southend fan, well, it's turned him off, but he has a plan. We'll find out that a little bit later. Welcome to the studio, Simon, Lee and Mark. I've been asking today, because it's the Six Nations, and it is my favourite competition, what are your favourite sporting tournaments? Simon, starting with you.
I'll offer something slightly different than the usual football or rugby. I'll go for a snowboarding tournament.
Thought you'd say that.
I would offer up the Winter X Games, where they have an event called Slope Style, where it's all the jumps and the rails. Mm-hmm. But actually, I'll tell you what I'd offer is Jenny Jones winning a medal for Britain in the Winter Olympics in the Slope Style competition there. Fantastic.
Good call.
FA Cup. And after the weekend previous, when Bradford beat Chelsea, Middlesbrough beat Man City, it was fantastic. And what I really want to do one day is, you always get those stories of fans that go right from the beginning, you know, sort of the qualifying rounds, and then they follow each team that wins mm-hmm. until they get to the final. I'd love to do that one day.
Well, we're speaking more to you about this and how you reckon you've got a plan to beat the ridiculous ticket prices turning people off sport. Mark, yourself?
Big fan of the Olympics after they came to London in 2012. Because, I mean, at any time of day on the TV, you can watch all sorts of sports, from Greco-Roman wrestling to fencing to stuff you've never even heard of before.
Mark, I think Annie is with you on that one. So how can people get in contact, and what favourite competitions are there?
We've got here, Smoking Tootin has said Rugby World Cup 2003, slightly retrospective, and Euro 96 as well as a favourite sporting events. Sarah says it's the World Cup in soccer, no doubt. Soccer, I know.
Yeah,
all a bit American, soccer, aren't we? And actually, American Mark has said the FIFA World Cup Summer, the Olympics and the US NCAA Basketball Championship. Championships, nicknamed March Madness. It's basically like the FA Cup, he says, but it's 68 colleges and university teams playing a tournament over a month. And Victoria Layton says it's the most wonderful time of the year, only one of the times that I miss living in Cardiff. That is, of course, in relation to Six Nations that Georgie's been talking about a lot. And Ben says Rosslyn Park Sevens when I was a schoolboy.
Very interesting, as Lee Boyce pricks up his ears and his eyes there, because we'll be talking about that a little bit later. Annie, how can people get in contact?
Okay, so you can tweet us at Share Radio UK, email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk, give us a call on 020-338-49849, and you can also leave a message on our Facebook page.
Thank you very much, Annie.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio, on digital, online and through that Share Radio mobile app. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1. Now, this is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money. In the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert, journalists Lee Boyce and Mark Schoffman for our weekly catch-up. Now, boys, it's been reported that the city regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, is cracking down on equity crowdfunding. This comes after their investigation found that most companies in the fast-growing sector were misleading investors about the risk. Let's first hear from Share Radio's personal finance expert, Ed Bauscher, who himself has invested in equity crowdfunding.
It enables the likes of you and me, Georgie, to invest in young businesses, startup businesses that aren't ready yet to go on the stock market. So there's various crowdfunding sites, equity crowdfunding sites, people like Crowdcube and Seeders. You go to the Crowdcube site, you'll see lots of businesses, young businesses looking for money, and and you can then invest as little as £10, £100, £1,000, and you get a share in the business. Obviously, there's a big chance those businesses won't succeed, but the dream is that you'll invest in the future Facebook or whatever it is and make a ton of money, and you never know, you just might.
What power does the Financial Conduct Authority have?
So the FCA, it does now regulate the industry, so if you're going on an equity crowdfunding site, it's well worth checking to make sure it says at the bottom regulated by the FCA, and that should mean that they're not going to completely rip you off, but you still need to be wary because this is such a young industry. The FCA have said in this latest report they don't want this industry to die. They think it's good news. It's good for the UK economy. Mm. It means more people can set up young businesses that might create employment in the future. But they're concerned about some of the marketing. I think some of the sites have been putting out ads that don't flag up the risk. In Crowdcube, the biggest site, I saw an ad they had up on the Tube before Christmas, and I was surprised, shall we say. It was not highlighting the risk at all, and those ads disappeared quite quickly. The FCA is saying that an unnamed site has withdrawn its advertising. I think I know who that is. The FCA flags up another issue is that, fine, let's say you put £1,000 into a company. It's a big winner. When all the people on the equity crowdfunding site invested, they got 20% of the company for the money they put in. Lovely. And they put in £100,000, say. And then a year on, the business is doing quite well. It needs more money. At that stage, the business might say, well, we need more money. We're not going to go back to the crowdfunding site. We'll go to the venture capital investors. Fine. Nothing wrong with that. The venture capital guys put in £1 million. But the risk is the venture capital guys get a very, very good deal, and the crowdfunding guys get completely sort of walked over and suddenly find that the value of their shares is way, way too low. And the FCA is concerned about that. So it's encouraging the crowdfunding platforms to be really aware of that and to make sure when the venture capital guys come in that the crowdfunding sites are defending the interests of the little guys who've already invested.
Well, those were the views of Share Radio's personal finance expert, Ed Bauscher. It's after the City Watchdog launched a crackdown on so-called peer-to-peer and crowdfunding firms, which lend savers cash to companies and individuals in return for, well, better interest rates. So let's start off by asking Simon, because I know you're very into, you write your minor investor column. So this is really one for you, I guess. First of all, what is the difference? Peer-to-peer, crowdfunding, mini-bonds, what are they all?
Well, this is a pretty broad area, to be perfectly honest, and, you know, sometimes it all gets bracketed under this concept of crowdfunding. Mm. But essentially, you've got three quite different things coming into play here. But the thing that links them all is they're basically disrupting the current financial system. They're putting people who want to borrow money or raise money directly in touch with investors who can cut out the middleman and hopefully get better returns. With crowdfunding, you've got two separate kinds. You've got equity crowdfunding, where essentially you're buying a share in an unlisted company. You're taking a little stake in that company, giving them some money to go and grow and expand or start up. You also have the sort of product-based crowdfunding, which doesn't fall under this FCA regulation, which is like Kickstarter, where basically people have a great idea for a business or a product, and they put it up there and they say, hey, raise some money, and when we raise the money, we'll make this product, and we'll send you the product as a reward. And there's some really interesting ideas that have been funded out of that. You've also got this mini-bond scenario, where basically companies are essentially issuing IOUs, bonds, and they're promising to pay you a set interest rate return. So they'll say, we'll pay you 7% a year, you lend us the money, we'll use that money to expand. You've also then, at the other end of the spectrum, got the peer-to-peer lending industry, which is also referred to as lend-to-save. And that's where you're basically lending money through a platform. There's three big ones in the UK, Zopa, RateSetter and Funding Circle. And you're lending either to individual borrowers, personal borrowers, or businesses who are taking out a loan, as you would take out a personal loan or a business loan. And people's money is pulled together to lend to them, and then they pay it back with interest. And it's a very exciting area. It's emerged really strongly since the credit crunch. I think it is fundamentally a good thing.
What sort of rates can you get before we start talking about the risk?
Yeah, before we start talking about the risk.
You have written that you are cautiously optimistic there at This Is Money, and we will talk about the risks involved. But what are the rates? Why are people attracted to them first and foremost?
Okay, so we wrote a story a while back about one of these one of these mini bonds that has gone sour now, actually. It was called a secured energy bond, and it offered 6.5% to people who were going to put solar panels on roofs.
Give us context of what 6.5% is in this environment.
Well, in this environment, the best rate you're going to get on a five-year fixed-rate savings account is probably just under 3%. I think, is that right, Lee?
It's just a little over 3%.
Yeah. Just a little over 3%. Mm-hmm. So you're basically getting twice the rate of return. If you were to go out and buy a traditional corporate bond fund where you're lending to, you know, established companies, and you're spreading your risk, then you might be getting a sort of 4.5% return. Mm-hmm. That 6.5% probably looks pretty good to people when they're looking at low rates or interest, you know, the base rate of 0.5%, an instant access savings account of 1.5%. But I don't think people are actually really weighing up how much risk they're taking for the reward. And what you need to be looking at is, I could lose all of my money on this. This is at the riskier end of the investing spectrum. And am I getting a big enough return above a fixed rate savings account, which is protected by the FSCS, the dividend yield I could get on a share, or the return that I would get on a corporate bond, especially if it's from, for example, a bond fund where someone spread the risk for me?
Yeah, the bond that you talked about, the mini bond you talked about, 6.5%, doesn't actually seem huge amount when you think of the risk for this particular case. Lee, you were writing about this, weren't you?
Yeah, so I think my biggest problem is with this. So it launched in October 2013. Now, A, it said it was a secured energy bond. And in a lot of the marketing material, they said that they were working with a company that was FCA backed, which gives a sort of illusion that it's safer than actually what it was. And also, I think because it's quite, you can get it set in your head what is happening with this investment. You're putting money in, they're putting solar panels and roofs on schools. Schools are saving money, you get your money back. Here's a 6.5% payment each quarter. And I think because people can kind of visualise that, they were quite encouraged to put money in. And a minimum investment of £2,000, the money that they made, which was £7.5 million, they ended up completing 5 projects, and most of the money got siphoned off to their parent company in Australia, which they used to pay off debt. And now that's gone bust. A lot of questions still unanswered. We don't know if there's any money left for bondholders to fight back for.
What sort of regulation, what sort of protection is it? Because it's not covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, is it?
No, so there's no compensation scheme. And people would have known that.
Remind us what that Financial Services
Compensation... £50,000. So for an investment, it's £50,000. For a savings account, it's £85,000.
On a savings account, you're covered, you know, for your deposit, the money you've put in, if that licensed bank goes bust. Yep. With an investment, you're not covered in the same way. You're not covered for losing money, for example, if the bond just, you know, plummets in value or a share plummets in value. You're covered mainly for like sort of maladministration and things like that. So if you lose money because someone's basically not done what they're meant to have done, you can then try and look at that. And I think Lee's point there is really good, actually, about people like the story here. And actually, that's one of the big things about crowdfunding and mini bonds is people are investing in stories here. There's some really good storytelling going on. I'm not saying it's fictional storytelling, but there's people telling great stories about their businesses, putting up a good video. And on the crowdfunding sites, you tend to find that the projects that get overfunded don't necessarily reflect that someone's got a groundbreaking idea or an amazing business. They tend to reflect that they've told the story really well.
Marketing,
and they've
really
done a really good video. Yeah, and it's marketing. Yeah. And I think there's also a problem where people aren't spreading their risk properly. You really shouldn't be putting more than, say, 2 or 3% of your total investable wealth into any single one of these things. And if you look at it and you think, well, you know what, if I lose all of my money, I'll just chalk that one up to experience and recognise I took a risk, then yeah, invest. But if you're not going to feel like that, if you lose your money, be very, very careful about it.
The risk is high, but then so are the returns. And so you've got to think, well, quid pro quo, surely I should know what I'm getting myself in for.
And yeah, they are. But
nothing comes for free, Simon.
So I tell you what, one other thing that people don't do here, on the crowdfunding sites, particularly the equity crowdfunding sites, basically they've got a target for the amount of money they're raising. And they'll usually tell you how much equity they're giving away for that. Now, what you need to do is work backwards from that and that target and that equity they're raising, and look at what valuation are they putting on their business. Because however great someone's little coffee chain is, if they're putting a £40 million valuation on it, then there's a lot of room for disappointment there if things go wrong. And you know that bit in Dragon's Den where they do exactly that and they go, you want 40 million for that?
Well, that was excellent. Yeah, that was excellent.
It's that you need to be doing. And also be very careful about words like security and secondary markets. And Mark, you've been looking at something this week, haven't you, to do with buy-to-let?
Yeah, so I've been covering a new buy-to-let crowdfunding platform called Property Partner, which takes in money from investors to crowdfund buying a property, which the platform then appoints someone to let out, and then you get the rental yield and potentially capital growth if it's ever sold. But another way they're marketing this product is by saying there's a secondary market where you can sell your shares if you want to exit. Now, this sounds great for someone who comes on and they think, oh, great, I've got this potential return, but also if I want to leave, it'll be easy. But in reality, you need someone to actually be around to buy those shares, and there's no guarantee that that's going to happen.
I could set up a secondary market for the coffee cup on that desk and say, I've got a secondary market. Unless we've got a load of people in here who want to buy coffee cups, then there is no market.
And you have a lot of cups out there.
Yeah, exactly. But you are cautiously optimistic about this method, aren't you? I mean, it's helped startups, some companies that otherwise wouldn't be able to do it. And like you said, it's disrupting the traditional model.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. There's loads of small companies out there in Britain doing really wonderful things. We've got this thriving small manufacturing industry at the moment. Did you know there's now more manufacturing in London than there was before the credit crunch? And, you know, we're making things and we're exporting them. We've got great tech companies. We've got people coming up with really good ideas. There's a really good entrepreneurial spirit. And a lot of those people get very disillusioned by the whole bank funding process, and also probably find the whole venture capital funding process a bit scary and probably a bit above them. The ability to just go out, raise some money and say, put some money in this, we'll give you a share in the business, is great. And also, you know, peer-to-peer lending, LenderSafe, we think has been really, really good. You know, we've supported the big firms who've done this. I mean, Lee, as our savings correspondent, you know, has done a lot on this, and he's got some pretty good advice for anybody who's considering putting some money into it.
I think if I was going to pick one of these, you know, bands to go through, peer-to-peer would be the one I would pick personally, because especially the big three companies, which are Zupa, Funding Circle and RateSetter, as we said earlier. So Zupa and RateSetter lend to individuals. So you lend your money and they borrow it and then they pay back in instalments. But the default rate is really quite low. So they do sort of like evaluate the risk quite well. And then actually, I think Funding Circle is probably my favourite out of the three, because that's for business. So businesses that have traditionally been turned down by banks, you know, banks aren't interested. They put their, you know, Funding Circle do all the vetting process, put it on there, and then you can pour money into it. And you almost feel like you're helping that business sort of grow. But as Simon said this a minute ago, you shouldn't put too much of your wealth into these, you know, things. But I think peer-to-peer, if I had to pick out of any of them, I think it's most solid. And those three also have an association body, which I think is quite important.
The Peer-to-Peer Finance Association. The chairman of that trade body, Christine Farnish, quoted as saying, our strict set of membership rules includes high standards of transparency by providing clear, balanced and fair information to all customers. Any member who does not abide by these rules faces expulsion. I think on a wider note, though, what the Financial Conduct Authority had a problem with was the way that things are marketed as well. And we've heard personal finance expert Ed Bauscher saying he was on the tube and couldn't believe it when he saw an advert for one of these crowdfunding sites. The FCA said they gave an unrealistically optimistic impression of the investments. And in worst cases, companies were deleting negative comments from forums on their website where customers could discuss investment performance.
Well, what I would like to know is, A, how did that advert get through the process to be allowed on the tube and wherever else it was? And if the advertising board that obviously gives it the OK has got any sort of alarm bells, why is it not asking the FCA for advice, saying, look, we've got this, is this realistic? You know, that is the first thing that I would ask.
A very good question to ask as well. That voice you're hearing is Lee Boyson. We'll be talking a little bit more about pension bonds in a very short moment.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Welcome. If you've just joined us, this is Consuming Issues here on Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert with journalists Lee Boyce and Mark Schoffman from This Is Money. That's the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Now, according to a recent report, many savers who applied by post for the in-demand pensioner bonds still haven't had their money taken or even received confirmation of their application. And that's almost 3 weeks later. The bonds offer high interest rates and went on sale last month. Lee, firstly, remind us the ins and outs of pension bonds, what they are, who's eligible, etc.
Sure. So pension bonds launched on January 15th. They're for over 65s. You could put £10,000 into either 1 year bond that pays 2.8%, or a 3 year bond that's 4%, or you can have £10,000 in each. The opening days of when they became available, very popular product because savings rates obviously so low at the moment, they beat anything else that's out there. So it was a mad scramble. £1.1 billion was poured in 2 days. And there's a 10 billion cap. So it shows you 10% in 2 days. That's the sort of, you know, drive that these pension bonds have.
Given the conversation we've just been having about low rates,
exactly.
It's not really
so
surprising.
4% over 3 years is pretty decent.
So NLS and I were well prepared for the...
Well, you'd like to think so. And they did take on extra staff for the call centres, etc. But it just wasn't enough. We've had various reports. So last week I'd written something about people that had their money taken twice. So we covered all of that stuff. I think refunds now have come back out. But now the latest one, and I've had lots of readers getting in touch this week, lots of worried readers who have either sent checks because they prefer to use checks or because they couldn't get through in those initial days on the telephone. So they filled in a postal application, they've sent it via the post office, recorded delivery. The check has been signed off at NSI, they've received it, but it hasn't been cashed in yet. And some people had their check sent in and received the day after. So 3 weeks later, people still haven't had their money taken out of their accounts. And it makes it difficult for you to manage your accounts. And £10,000, if you're going for the maximum amount, is not a small amount of money. So people have been worried about whether or not they're going to be open, these bonds. And
knowing you as I do, Lee, with your investigative qualities, I'm sure you've been in contact with NS&I. What have they been telling you?
Well, they said that, you know, there was a high volume of postal applications, but of course there's going to be a high volume of postal applications. A lot of people are over 65, you know, not tarring everyone with the same brush, but a lot don't like to go on the internet and open products like this. They'd rather fill in a postal application, send in their check, know it's been received, and, you know, the bond's opened. And actually, on the NS&I information part of the website, it says that as soon as they get the check, they will cash it. So 3 weeks later, well, it doesn't seem to be the case for a lot of readers. So what they told me is that 730 additional staff members have been working on the bonds.
Wow.
430 of these are in the back office. So that tells you that more than half are in the back office dealing with postal applications. So they've obviously had a fair flood come in. Now, what they said to me at the end was that they're implementing a number of measures to ensure customers who post applications are aware of the state of their transaction, including outbound calls, texts and emails, confirming receipt and likely timescales. Why didn't they do that at the start? So they're just doing that now. They're going to implement that now. They're going to say, they're going to send an email. I'd be expecting that straight away. I'd be wanting a letter. I want a phone call. Yeah, we've got your £10,000 cheque. It's going to be cashed next week. Or, sorry, we've had a bit of a delay. It's going to happen next week. It's just been a complete blanket of silence, in my opinion. And it's just not good enough.
So what are your readers saying? What should they do?
Well, the advice from NS&I was to hang tight. Basically, and these checks will be cashed. If you've sent a check, recorded delivery, and you've got that proof that it's been received, they've got the check. They're just getting through the process. The trouble
is, how do you know there's any left though, as well? Because they're not actually telling us how many are left. They did at the start, and now they've stopped.
I did a blog about this again last week because it kind of annoyed me a little bit. How can you, after 2 days, say, oh, £1.1 billion, wow, this is such the most successful product in recent financial history, blah, 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 blah. And then George Osborne says, you know, they're going to be available for months. How can you say that for certain when you've already had 10% fill in 2 days? I mean, if it kept going at that pace, it would have been closed by now. So we don't know how close we are to the 10 billion barrier. We could be miles away. Who knows? But
people could still be sending in their money with no idea.
This is it. So I don't know what would happen in that situation. I don't know if you'd just be rejected or what would happen. But they basically said that they wouldn't be providing us a running commentary of how much money has been poured into these bonds, which I'm not asking for running commentary. I don't need it every day. It's not a horse race. I don't need once a week update just to say, well, look, we've had £4 billion come in. People have still got a bit of time, but, you know, it's running out. So I have got sympathy with NS&I because I know this is going to be a popular product and it is probably a limitation of staff that they can take on. But the lack of communication for me has been the big no-no. The biggest advice I can give is just keep plodding along and trying to get in contact on the telephone. I mean, some readers saying it's taking half an hour still to get through. Some readers say if you leave it till sort of late evening, it's actually easier to get through. So it's just these little tricks and things you can do, I guess, to try and get hold of them. But I find if you're sending someone £10,000 of your money and you're having to chase up to see if they've taken your money, it's almost like the opposite of crowdfunding and everything. You know, they want your money. It's almost like they don't want your money.
So when do the savings actually start, though? Is it when they cash the cheque?
This has been the other question. People are worried that they've sent their cheque in, it's been received, and they're not going to start earning interest until it's been cashed. Very valid question.
Because in a very low interest rate, if it's a month just hanging in the ether, you've lost 10 to 15 quid, and I'll get Simon to check that maths.
Exactly right, and that's what people have been asking us, and will they be losing out on interest? And the firm answer that I've had from NS&I is no, they will backdate it. So if they received a cheque on the 16th of January, as one reader did, and it hasn't been cashed, they said that they will backdate the interest. If it doesn't, you'll be hearing about it.
Indeed. There's been plenty of other pension news as well around. A new cap on pension charges that ministers said will save average earners £100,000 over their lifetimes. I don't know what you guys think of that. The plan's aimed at stamping out, of course, these high and unclear charges and designed to boost the value of pension pots when people retire, with expected £200 million from the pensions industry transferred to savers over the next 10 years.
Well, there's three things that are proven to work if you're going to be investing for the long term. Those are reinvesting dividends, asset allocation, so basically making sure that you're not too exposed to one area, and low charges. And low charges are something that it's actually quite easy for you to control. So actually this is really important, because the difference between having 1.5% of your pension eaten every year and 0.75% of your pension being eaten every year in charges is quite substantial when you multiply that up by 20 or 30 years. So this is a good move, and actually what you'll probably see is that the charges will fall down below that 0.75%. You're not going to see a point where they're all just at that 0.75%. And actually the biggest risk with many of these schemes is not actually people who are in their current employer's work pension, where actually their employer's keeping tabs on it and making sure their employees have got low charges. It's people who've moved jobs and left a pension in an old pension scheme, or people with old personal pensions, or sort of old style personal pensions like managed by life companies and things like that. You know, if you've got a SIP on a DIY investing platform, you've probably got pretty keen charges and you can go out and compare them. But with some of these legacy pensions, people are seeing quite a lot of their retirement fund being eaten up. So this can only be a good thing.
Simon, what does a SIP on a DIY investing platform mean?
Oh, well, you've caught me on the jargon there, haven't you? If you've got a pension that you... A SIP is a self-invested personal pension. So it's basically you're managing your own pension and you're controlling what you put into it. So you choose what funds or shares or investment trusts or even other things that you put in there, and you manage it through a DIY investing platform, which is where you can go online and you can do it all yourself. So there you go.
Just to back you off on this one, take a listen to this.
Jargon Busters. Leading you through the financial labyrinth.
A self-invested personal pension plan, otherwise known as a SIP, is a personal pension plan where you control where your money is invested. The pension is just a wrapper for the individual investment choices you're making. But unlike other pension schemes, there are no fund managers deciding how to invest your money. It's all up to you. Contributions to SIPs are treated the same as contributions to other types of personal pension. So the benefits of investing in a SIP are identical to those of investing in a normal pension. Although SIPs have become increasingly popular, because it depends on the expertise of the individual who's contributing to the scheme, they are usually only considered by expert investors.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. He joins me in the studio today with journalists Lee Boyce and Mark Shoffman for our weekly catch-up. We've been talking about pensioner bonds. Now let's turn our attention to fixed-rate mortgages set to move closer to 1% as HSBC has announced their record low two-year fixed rate at 1.9%. So what's the catch, Mark Shoffman? I understand you're the mortgage man who's been looking into this. Is this offer too good to be true?
Well, as with all financial products, you have to watch out for that fee. And HSBC, with this mortgage, has a high fee of £1,499. And you'll also need a 40% deposit. So yeah, that's a lot, isn't it?
Put the fee into context.
Well, fees do tend to vary. Mm-hmm. For the kind of lowest rate mortgages, you do tend to have to pay a higher fee as a result. But as they get higher, you can sometimes have fee-free mortgages where the rate's a bit higher instead. Or occasionally you do get a decent offer where you've got fees of around £200, £400, maybe £999.
Are there others on offer that charge a lower fee than that?
So with this deal, as an example, you could pay a little bit more with Yorkshire Building Society, which I believe charges 1.27%, but has a lower fee of £975. By weighing up the fee and the rate, you end up saving about £300, just over £300, I think. So it's always worth calculating the overall cost of a mortgage and not just rate chasing.
Yes, of course.
And I should point out, actually, that we have a calculator on our website that can do that for you.
Very good,
Simon. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/calculate, you will find our true cost mortgage calculator there, and you can plug in rival deals with different fees and it will tell you which one is the cheapest over the deal period. And these fees are big, and often people leave comments saying, well, it's not worth remortgaging with a £1,500 fee. But you shouldn't let that put you off, because actually, with rates this low, a lot of people could save a lot of money, and it could be worth them paying the fee. Or even, as Mark says, paying a slightly higher rate and going fee-free.
And when you're talking about 25 years, of course, but the fee isn't perhaps the thing that bothers me the most. The one that bothers me is the 40% deposit.
Well, mortgage rates across most deposit levels have been falling. I think HSB also offers 95% loan-to-value mortgages, where you would just need a 5% deposit for 4.49%. And that's a pretty low... Well, it's a high rate compared to, obviously, that, but you're paying a lower deposit. And that fee is actually quite competitive for that sort of level.
Also, we're talking here for a two-year deal, am I right? What happens after 2 years?
So after 2 years, traditionally on a mortgage, you would move to the standard variable rate that the bank sets itself. I'm not sure off the top of my head what HSBCs are, but they're usually a lot higher. So the trick is to remortgage, try and get a better rate so you're not stuck on that SVR.
And that's where those fees start really racking up. If you take out two-year fixed-rate deals and you pay £1,500 every time you remortgage. And also, there is a risk that if you take one of these two-year fixed rates, you're going to be coming off it just at the point when interest rates are starting to move up.
Yes.
At the moment, we've got this lower for longer scenario on interest rates where people do not expect interest rates to go up for some time. There's a lot of bad stuff going on in the background involving Greece, the Eurozone, Russia, oil price. All those things are keeping expectations of interest rates on the floor. It could be very different in 2 years' time. So we tend to prefer five-year fixed rate because that fits in a bit more with the sort of people tend to move, if they do move, more on like a five-year kind of phase rather than a two-year phase. Rates are really low on those at the moment. You can lock into a mortgage at less than 2.5%. In fact, First Direct announced they've a new record low rate today of a five-year fixed rate. You just got to be careful that if you do think you're going to move in 2 years' time, be careful about taking a five-year fixed rate, because whilst you can theoretically take it with you on many of those deals, you're still going to need to be reassessed. You have the property reassessed by the bank, and you might find that they turn around and say, no, you can't.
I'm no expert, Simon, about the crash, but it all sounds rather familiar with these teaser rates, potentially. And then when they came into the standard variable rate in America, that's when everybody couldn't pay their bills?
Well, this is a very interesting point, actually. So one of the things that was credited with causing the financial crisis and the credit crunch, if you look, trace it all the way back to the American mortgage market, where people were being lent money who basically just could not pay it back. And it was basically on the basis that they thought house prices would keep going up, and so you'd always be able to flip the house. It didn't matter if you couldn't pay back the mortgage, because by the time you got to the point where you needed to start making the payments, the house was worth more money, you sold it on and off you went. And teaser rates were actually pinpointed as one of the main problems. Now, in America, they don't have exactly the same looking mortgage market as us with the kind of fixed rate scenario that we have. But they did have what they called teaser rates, where you'd get an ultra low rate to begin with, and then it would jump after that period. I mean, in some instances, people were basically paying no interest for maybe 6 months or a year, and then all of a sudden the rate kicked in. Now, what's never really been picked up on is that actually the way our fixed rate mortgage market works, especially with our love of 2 year fixed rate mortgages, is essentially we operate on a teaser rate system here, where you get teased in with a super low rate of 1.19%, for example, and then in 2 years' time, HSBC's standard variable rate, I think, is just below 4%. If that stays the same, in 2 years' time, your mortgage rate will go up to nearly 4%. So, yeah, that is a teaser rate. And if you do take a mortgage, a two-year fixed rate mortgage, or even a five-year fixed rate mortgage, do plan ahead. Make sure that you realise that down the line, you could end up paying a higher rate, because you want to be very careful about borrowing money at 1.19% on the basis that you'll always be able to borrow money at 1.19%. Fortunately, we've got new mortgage rules that have come in that means banks have to do affordability checks and stress test their borrowers, and they're checking up as to whether you can afford that mortgage at 5-6% interest, not at, you know, 1.2% interest.
It just seems all the ingredients are there, though, doesn't it, with the house price rises. But how can you, as you said there, plan for the future so much when interest rates are going to go up? We don't know what impact Europe's going to have. There's so many variables to consider.
Well, so to be honest, I think that fixed rate mortgages at the moment look extremely attractive. The idea of fixing your mortgage for 5 years below 2.5%, that is phenomenally cheap. These 2 year fixed rates, even though we've tended to prefer 5 year fixed rates, I look at these and I think those are so low that it is potentially worth taking a punt on one of those. You know, I've actually looked at whether it was worth me moving my mortgage to a 2 year fixed rate just because it would be so cheap on these rates. But I wrote something, you know, three years ago, I think, I need to dig it out, saying how low could five-year fixed rates go, and if they went below 3.5%, they were a gimme. You just had to take them. I mean, they've gone a long way below 3.5%. You know what? I don't have one. I've got a tracker mortgage as well, because I personally think interest rates are going to stay lower for longer, and I'm willing to take the risk that I'm wrong. And if I am wrong, we've worked out that we can afford it if the rate goes up. So basically, set aside a bit of extra money every month, put that into a savings account, then if rates do go up, you're used to paying more, and you've got a reserve fund, and if they don't go up, you're laughing.
Mark, you were nodding along there.
I moved to a five-year fixed rate at the beginning of last year, when everyone was saying rates are falling and they're going to start going back up, and now I could remortgage onto something cheaper. So yeah, it is hard to time that, but I think I also have that thing where I know I've locked in my repayments now for 5 years or now four more years. So I know I can also put some money aside for when we do eventually come off this deal and kind of enter a market where rates probably are going to be higher.
Lee, nodding along as well.
That's just very sensible advice. Well, yeah, you should save, if you can save the extra money that you're with a fixed mortgage like that, you should put it aside. But the other thing I was going to say is that back in April, the mortgage market review means that a lot of people now that are borrowing, you know, for a mortgage have to go through quite stringent stress testing. Yeah. So they will test if you can afford, I think, maybe 7% or something like that. So it's quite a high level, and it's obviously something that has worried government since the crash. People, you know, need to be aware that, oh, OK, it's all well and good saying you can get a 3% rate or whatnot, but if it's going to go up to 7%, in a year, what is your, you know, your finances? Could you afford that? And I think that has actually been a good thing.
One of this that's brought to my mind, certainly, and we're about to talk about credit cards and switching and shifting to 0% balance transfer deals a little bit later on, is in terms of credit, and we do love our credit cards in this country, are we sitting on this debt bomb almost waiting to explode with these interest rates set to rise? And you can't, how can we guarantee how long these zero rates are going to last for? What happens at the end of that time if you can't pay? I'm wondering if we're also in another way sitting on a sort of...
In terms of the credit cards.
In terms of credit cards and balance transfers. If everyone's turning to shift over to these zero, you can't guarantee how long they're going to last for. There's a war going on. They're all lasting for sort of 30 months now, or 23, depending.
36 months is the longest I think you can get on a credit card balance transfer. So just stop and think about that for 1 minute. Basically, a credit card company will lend you money for 36 months without charging you a penny of interest. They'll charge you a fee to move the balance, but they will not charge you any interest. That is astonishing. Now, why are they doing that? Well, the reason why they'll lend you money for 36 months at 0% is because in the back room, they've got some very smart people who've crunched the numbers and worked out that enough people won't pay back over 36 months at 0% interest. And instead, at the end of the 36 months, instead of actually moving somewhere else where they can get another 0% balance transfer, they'll fall onto a higher rate and they'll end up paying enough interest that it's profitable for that credit card company to give you free money for 3 years. There is actually this issue where what happens if the regulator suddenly turns around and says, do you know what? These credit card rates, these teaser rates, these are a problem. We need to stop this and we're going to call time on it. I mean, I think that there would be a huge outcry because it's going to cause a lot of people who've got 0% balance transfers a big problem. But it's not beyond the realms of possibility. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that the banks decide they don't want to do it anymore. RBS and NatWest, I think, has scrapped what it calls teaser rates on credit cards. This happened with the credit crunch and the financial crisis. The big problem a lot of people faced is they'd basically taken out mortgages, two-year fixed-rate mortgages, on the basis that they would never, ever pay the standard variable rate because they'd remortgage at that point. What happened was, basically, banks suddenly shut down. They didn't want to lend anybody any money. People couldn't remortgage. You know, remortgages evaporated. Standard variable rates started going up, and house prices started falling, so people were seeing their equity in their home falling, and they weren't actually able to remortgage at a rate that was attractive. Luckily, the Bank of England decided to take interest rates down to 0.5%, and that saved a lot of people's bacon.
We'll talk about this a little bit more in a few short moments.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Well, that voice you were hearing there was editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. He's here in the studio with me today with journalists Lee Boyce and Mark Shoffman. We were talking there about credit cards and switching and these zero balance transfer deals. My concern is, as well, if you miss a payment, it can go back to...
Yeah, they'll put you on the rate, I think, that it will be at the end of... If you had that 36-month deal...
So 1 year in, say...
And if you miss a payment, yeah, that is the biggest no-no with a balance transfer card. Yeah, you have to stick to a plan. I get asked a lot of questions from friends, you know, being a financial journalist. The biggest one I ever get asked about is a balance transfer. It's really interesting. Like, a lot of friends like to... Credit card, I suppose this time of year it's very popular because it's run up to Christmas and new year, new start and all that. And I think people go, well, I've got £2,500 perhaps on a credit card and an overdraft and I'm racking up various amounts of interest on that. And these deals come up and entice you in. And I think as long as you stick to a plan and you say to yourself, right, I've got this, well, the example we gave there was £3,000, I could pay £250 a month as long as nothing changes over the year and it will be gone. You know, but then you have to be careful not to spend on your credit card and start. And that's the danger. And that's what Simon was saying about people crunching numbers behind the background. You have to stick to the plan.
But you've got to wonder why you're... I mean, some people obviously will need it. There will be emergencies, etc. But you've got to wonder why you're sort of getting into a situation where you need to do that. And many people are taking, well, more than one if they can get it.
I just think, especially my generation, I think it's a lot of it is built on credit. You know, people just get a credit card. They like to travel around. They like to buy nice things. And the focus on saving for sort of under 30s, I think, is just there is no focus.
And yet, if you look across to the rest of the continent, they don't seem to love the credit cards as much as we do.
No, but I mean, we've got a very, what would be termed sophisticated financial industry in this country. We've got a very sophisticated, you know, internet industry. That's why there's all this crowdfunding stuff and peer-to-peer stuff going on in the UK. And people launch products and ideas in the UK because we're seen as quite open to new ideas, both financially and, you know, doing stuff on the internet. I mean, maybe you can trace some of this back to the whole university scenario. You went to university, you had your student loan, but then also you had banks falling over themselves to offer you an overdraft, of an interest-free overdraft of £2,000. Then when you finished university, they were falling over themselves. Oh, and they were falling over themselves to give you a credit card while you were there as well, even though you weren't earning any money. Then at the end of it, they're offering you a graduate loan, and there's lots of people who can reach the age of 30, and they're still actually carrying personal debt that they picked up in their early 20s. They've just been shuttling it around. And there is a problem where if you do want to do the sensible thing and take out a personal loan to pay this off, where you've got a set repayment plan over a period of time, you're going to be paying interest, but, you know, you're paying off in chunks. When people go to apply for those loans, attracted by the rates that are advertised of, say, you know, 4%, 6%, they actually discover that they can't get them, you know, because they only have to offer them to 51% of successful applicants. And instead, they're offered a loan at 15%, 16%. I know someone who's been trying to do this, and she's been offered rates on loans that are effectively more expensive than the credit card she's got the debt on.
Do you think that it's going to last, these 0% deals that we're seeing? We're seeing a lot of competition.
It's really hard to say. I think another point to make as well is with the 36th month, if you need a longer deal, you pay a fee to move the money across. So I think it's typically sort of 2, 3%. So you have to remember that. And that makes sometimes the shorter terms a better proposition. I think there's a Santander one at the moment. It's 15 months and it's fee-free. So if you
Tesco do one which is 10 and that's fee-free as well. There's a few out there.
But then you really have to stick to the plan because you are going to get stung at the end. But in terms of how long they'll be around for, I mean, it's really difficult to tell. They've just been edging up and edging up the length of time every year.
But you did say, used in the right way, and if you plan for it properly, these things can be a great idea while they're here.
Yeah.
So you wrote an article from a reader, I think, wrote to you wanting to shift £3,000 of their credit card debt that they were paying interest on to this 0% balance transfer. Mm-hmm. But they were worried about hurting their credit rating. What did you find? Will it hurt your credit rating to move?
Well, temporarily is what I've been told. And as long as you're accepted. So it'll be about 6 months it will affect it slightly, and because banks and others want to see how you will manage that money. So as long as you're making the payments on it, after a couple of months it'll be fine. But if you get rejected, and you get rejected for, you know, a few in a short space of time, that's when it can really, really hurt your credit rating.
Are there any tips?
I think other than making sure what we've said already, not to go over the length of time, and to set a plan and stick with the plan and make sure you are paying off chunks and don't just leave it and all that sort of stuff, and also setting up a minimum payment on it and making sure that there is a regular payment going in. If you miss a payment, that is game over.
Cut that card up.
I was just going to say, I have a couple of tips. Yeah. Don't remember what the PIN code is. Don't use the card. I've done this myself, you see. And set up a standing order very quickly.
Yep.
Also, if you close your old account, I was told, if you close your old credit card, that can affect your credit rating. Is that true?
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that, actually. It's a very good question. I will find out.
So, I'm not sure that that is actually correct, in that what lenders look at, as I understand it, I had it explained to me, is that they're looking at your financial behaviour. They're also looking at how much of your available credit that you're using. So basically, say, for example, you take out a new card. If you don't pay off the balance on the old card, then you're using up more credit. So actually, that doesn't look good. But if you do pay off the balance on the old card, then you're using up a smaller amount of your available credit. And I don't know whether it matters whether you close that old card or not. I'm not entirely certain. We'll find out. The other thing that they do, that I do know, is that I was told by Experian, one of the credit reference agencies, but that when the lenders are looking at your credit report, they don't see that credit score that you see. So you see a credit score that goes up to, I think, 900. But that's just a representation to show you roughly where you are. And that can move around quite a lot. Spend a bit of money on your credit card and actually that can move the dial. But actually, the lenders are just seeing what you've done, so that you've applied for credit, you've done this, you've done that. So don't worry necessarily too much, you know, about that score. That's just representative. So if short term it's like wibbling around a bit, that's not necessarily too much of a concern.
But sometimes it is worth checking what your credit rating is, because it is very important,
check.
Isn't it? How can you do that?
Well, there's three main credit area agencies, Experian, Equifax and Cool Credit.
Cool Credit,
yeah. Experian, you get a free 30-day trial. You can check it for free, cancel it. You don't pay anything. You could do that through This Is Money, actually. Also, check you're on the electoral roll correctly. That's really, really, really important, and where a lot of people fall down. Just check for any stuff that's wrong. Any, you know, if it suggests you missed a payment, you didn't miss a payment, get that corrected. It's really important to get these things right.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now let's turn our attention to matters of a sporting nature. Lee, your resolution to watch local sports team for a tenner has rekindled your love for live football and rugby. Tell us more.
Well, I have been a little disillusioned with football, should I say, over the years.
Sure, you're not alone there, Lee.
You just see these absolutely huge wages, these owners coming in that have got no regard for the history. I'm talking about owners that come in and change colours of the kit and bring in loads of loan players from obscure Italian teams. And
yep. It's what football team could you be talking about?
Well,
there?
I'll let you do...
You're not talking about Watford there, are you, Lee?
I'll let you figure it out, but... I've just been a little bit fed up with it. And a few times I've been to sort of live matches recently, I've just found them a bit... Something's been missing. It's been a missing vital ingredient. And I just decided I'm terrible with New Year's resolutions. I never make them. I never stick to them. I thought this year I'm going to make one I can stick to. So I've been to see Dulwich Hamlet, who are a football team in the Ryman Premier, which is the seventh tier of English football. And I'd heard... Basically, there's a bit of a revolution going on down there, and it's a bit more of an experience. So I thought we're going to check it out. So I took a friend who really just has no interest in football whatsoever because he thinks it's too much money and, you know, just isn't for him. Took him along. We came in with a bag of bottles of beers, no problem. Bring in whatever you want, which I think is great. And just sit where you want, mingle who you want with. And everyone was just so friendly. You know, when I've been to... As you mentioned earlier, I'm a big Southend fan.
Yep.
Everyone's just a little bit wound up because the team might not be playing well and you really, really care about the result. So if the result's bad, you're just like, oh. But it's something like this. It's almost like it's the experience that it really sort of is good. And the bar was fantastic. Served all these craft beers, really nice gourmet food being sold. And everyone was just so friendly. And actually, the football on show... was pretty good. I mean, I've watched a lot of League Two football, and the difference between that and the Ryman Premier was not vast.
Yeah, it's astonishing when you said in your article how much it costs to go and see Southend. Mm. Currently battling in the promotion spots in League Two, with the matchday prices third highest at £21.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And also,
League Two football, you're like,
there's been a lot of ramblings going on the Southend forum that we're playing Stevenage soon, and the tickets there are £25.
Stevenage.
It's also worth pointing out here to the uninitiated that League Two is actually the fourth division.
I'm sorry, yeah. I should have said that.
So in old money, League Two is the fourth division. So anyone under the illusion that you're watching football one tier down from the top flight, you're not.
Well, with League Two and a bit of personal history, I used to go and watch Wimbledon play for years in the Premiership, as it was then. £115 for a child season ticket, not bad. Lovely. I had a little check on their website. It's £115 for a half-season ticket.
Wow.
So 12 games. Bearing in mind, that was the Premiership, now down to, as you said, the Division 4.
Yeah.
Which is quite a lot.
A lot of money. And BBC do this report every year, which shows how much tickets have gone up. I think it was almost 5% just this season. Again, and the problem is for me, I mentioned it in the blog there, but I've read this book about football scouts, and to cut a long story short, they talk about how younger players are getting paid absolutely obscene amounts of money, and they might not even make it into the first team, because where's the drive, where's the motivation? But it's people like us, the fans, that go, that are paying these absolutely... you know, astonishing wages, and I just find it a little bit disheartening.
The problem is, though, and I draw the comparison with rugby, Six Nations on, love it, and I think a lot of the reason I love it, I started to love it with football, is when it did start to get ridiculous. And I loved rugby because it had that kind of real feel. You can still sit among other fans, you can take some beer in if you want to, or buy it there. But you're slowly, steadily seeing with TV rights, it's going down the same route. And the more popular lower divisions are getting, as we've seen it, I've seen it happen over the years, and the more you get that sterile feeling that you were talking about.
It's horrible. And going down to Roslyn Park in southwest London really is the antidote for that. That was a tenner as well. And again, it was just everyone mingling around and having a good time.
They're National One, aren't they?
They are. Third tier.
Well, I mean, you know, you say about the Premier League teams that are in hot demand, you know, the TV companies are falling over themselves to pay money. Mark's an Arsenal season ticket holder.
I'd love to spend £25 on a ticket.
And he regularly sees empty seats.
Yeah, well, you do.
How much is a ticket at Arsenal?
So one ticket may range from, like, I don't know, 60 to 90 quid or maybe more. And it's a lot, isn't it? And a season ticket, I think the cheapest is 995, and then they go up to, I think, over 2 grand.
How much do you pay, Mark?
in between that. In case my wife is listening. Today.
So Lee, bang the drum then, final word. Has it given you the passion back?
It has, it really has. And I'm going to go tomorrow, actually. It's a big game, they're playing Canvey Island. Yeah, it really, really has rekindled my passion. And to have such a loose set of rules and being able to just go in, rock up, sit where you want, stand where you want, drink what you want, do what you want, speak who you want to, it's great.
Southend promotion?
Oh, definitely.
And Six Nations predictions?
England win.
Simon?
I don't know.
For goodness sake, Simon. Mark?
England lose, I reckon. Let's go for that. Is that bad? I don't really like rugby's.
Well, thank you very much to Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website Money section of the Mail Online. He was joined in the studio as well by editor Simon Lambert and Mark Schaffman.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.